Now that we've read the first creation story, let's move on to the second. Yes, that's what I said, the second creation story. Genesis 2, 4b and following is not an expansion of the first account, but a second different account of God's creation of the world. So why two stories? Well, the traditional academic answer is that these are from two different sources. And I think that's true, but the point for me is that now they are both here in a text that I believe to be inspired by God. So if one is true, does that make the other one false? Well, I don't think so. I would argue that both are God-inspired and both say something important about God and God's relationship to creation. Since I believe both are gifts of God, I don't think it's a matter of which is true and which is false. I don't think either is intended to give a scientific explanation of how God creates, but a theological interpretation of what it means for God to be creator and for us and, well, everything else to be a part of creation. The first account emphasizes creation through the Word of God, God's transcendence and the ordering life and things like that. The second account emphasizes that God is intimately involved in creation, that God sort of gets God's hands dirty, so to speak. Both these things are true about God, but they're hard to say in just one story. What's interesting to me is that even though these are from two different sources, I think that in the juxtaposition we see both commonalities and contrasts that enhance our understanding of God. I'll show you what I mean in a little bit. For now, you might pause and think about these questions for reflection. Does it bother you to think about two creation stories? As you read Genesis 2, look for the following things. What is the order of creation? How and why do you think it's different from that in Genesis 1? What does God seem to think about God's creation? What other similarities and differences do you see in the two accounts? Okay, so on to the text. Verse 2:5 starts back at the beginning. There's no one to work the ground, so there's no plants or animals or any of that yet. God causes a little rain to fall on the dust, takes some of the resulting clay, and forms a little clay person. There's a play on words in the Hebrew. In verse 7, the Adam, or the person, is formed from the Adama, or the ground. In English, we might say that the earth person is formed from the earth. The image and the verb used is that of a potter working on a wheel. But the little clay person isn't alive until God blows into the person's nostrils the breath of life. I personally love this way of expressing God's imparting of life. I want to take just a moment to think about life and death and living and non-living. When I was in the science lab, I sometimes watched organisms die under a microscope when we added certain substances to the slide they were on. It was odd to think that one moment this little organism was what we call living, and the next moment it was what we call dead. Physically, the change was very small. Some processes stopped working at the molecular level, and that's what caused the death. But at some level, the living organism and the dead one were exactly alike. As a pastor, I've been with people as they die, and that sense of the breath leaving them is very real. I understand on a scientific level that breath is not the only indicator of life, but I also understand why ancient people talked about the breath of life. That's the visible expression of the difference between life and death. But I'm also struck by the fact that there really is very little difference between a living human body and a dead one. We have a lot of trouble defining the boundary between life and death, or between living and non-living, on a medical or scientific level. We also have trouble on an ethical, moral level. We struggle with abortion because we're not sure if the fetus, while clearly living human tissue, is considered a live human. We struggle with when to pull the plug because it's not clear that maintaining the breath of life artificially is the same thing as really keeping somebody alive. All of these issues are raised for me when I contemplate what it means for God to make us out of the substance of the ground and to breathe into us the breath of life. I don't have answers for all the questions raised, but I am convinced of the need to wrestle with the issues. When you think about being made in the image of God, when you think about having the breath of God, what do you think it means? Do you think it makes a difference for our morality or ethics if we think of people in these ways as opposed to being merely the random products of a meaningless universe? Okay, well, back to the text. When God breathes into the clay person the breath or spirit of life, the clay person becomes a living person or a nephesh. In Hebrew, a nephesh, which often gets translated as soul, is a word that means a being full of passions and appetites, a self in the deepest sense of the word, maybe the essence of self, and it's a word used of both humans and animals. Now that God has made a living being, God can plant a garden because now there's someone to take care of it. Note how the verbs in this creation story, by the way, are action verbs. God is doing things, not just speaking. This garden is a wonderful, beautiful place, and in the middle of this garden, God plants not one, but two trees, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and the tree of life. We'll talk about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil in the next post. What's important for now is that God gives the person a job. Humans were created for a purpose, and God gave the person a command. Don't eat the tree in the middle. Did you notice that in Genesis 2, in contrast to Genesis 1, the first comment that God makes about God's work in creation is that it is not good. Specifically, it's not good for a person to be alone. God sees that the person needs a suitable or fit helper or partner. Now, sometimes that word helper, or azer in Hebrew, is seen as a subordinate person. However, in most cases, the Hebrew Bible, the word refers to God, so this is clearly not a reference to a subordinate. And if you want some references, look at the post in the written form. The making of the animals is God's first attempt to provide a helper. Nothing suitable is found, but the person gets to name the animals, just as God has named things in Genesis 1. So God causes a deep sleep to fall upon the person, the kind of deep sleep that in Hebrew connotes a religious experience. And God takes a side or a rib from the person and forms another person. This time the verb conjures up the image of a toolbox. God builds the woman. Now for the first time, the words used are those that are specifically male and female. The isha, or woman, is taken from the ish, or man. You can see that the words are related in something of the same way they are in English. So the Adam was taken from the Adama, and now the isha is built from the ish. That's kind of a nice parallel. When God gives the woman to the man is overjoyed and breaks into song, as Dr. Bill Power used to say, "Here at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh." Reflect on this statement for a while. What do you think this says about the relationship between men and women, or the difference in the human-human relationship and the human-animal relationship? The text also comments that a man leaves his mother and father and clings to his wife. Now, we know that's not true in the physical sense. Sociologically, or maybe anthropologically speaking, women were the ones who left home when married, not men. This is because women's skills were transportable and men's were not. Men's were tied to a particular plot of land, but women would take the products of the land and turn them into food and clothing and housing and in any setting. So if men do not leave physically, what is the sense in which they leave, do you think? Those of you who've heard my sermon on marriage already know what I think about this, but it's worth pondering. The last thing this account says is that the man and woman were naked and not ashamed. The word for naked also means vulnerable or open to harm. What does this say about the nature of ideal male-female relationships, or do you think it says anything at all? If you look in the post on the blog, you'll see some other things to think about. So take a look at that, and I'll see you next time. Bye.